everyone, and welcome back to the Research Talks podcast here from Stopbox, where, yes, we're having another interesting week, aren't we? It seems like every week is becoming pretty interesting. Of course, now we've got oil shortages worldwide and oil price just rocketing. We talked briefly about this a little bit last week, but it's still up there around $100. And it doesn't look like it's going to be coming down anytime soon, because even with the oil that could flow from out of Saudi Arabia through the pipeline, it's not going to anywhere near match what does come through the Strait of Hormuz. So yeah, that's the only thing that's really getting, well, I mean, the gold price is holding up as well, isn't it? But I mean, generally the stock market is down because of the fear of these global uncertainties. But Dan, what you've been keeping an eye on things, what's been going on in your world this week?
Yeah, I've been, like you, I've been keeping an eye on this macro situation. It does feel a little bit like there's a bit of hesitancy in the market generally as people wait to see some sort of conclusion to this. Seen a lot of stocks, to be honest, in the last couple of days move down, particularly in the among my mining holdings. But there have been been some outliers. Mandel's done well. We're going to talk about later on with its exposure to helium, which is being possibly positively impacted by this whole situation. And I always like to comment on Bitcoin. That's now above 71,000 as I look at my phone at the moment. So
indeed,
not nowhere near where it was, but at least it's not in the 60s right now. So yeah, we did see the Nigel Farage backed new stack treasury rise something like 200 to 300% this week, which was a bit of a reminder of last year. I think it has come back a little bit since, but if Bitcoin does continue to make its rise up, then we could see a bit of a return from those stocks that did so well last year.
Yeah, so what is that Nigel Farage thing?
I think I haven't looked at it too much, but I believe it's another treasury company.
Right, that he's behind or backing or something, endorsing.
Yes, okay. He's taken a significant stake in it.
Okay.
And backed also by some former members of the UK government, the former Chancellor, whose name escapes me right now. But yeah, so I think it's just another treasury play, a sort of UK-focused one.
Okay.
Maybe treasuries will have their moment in the sun again. We certainly
certainly
keep an eye on them.
Yeah, we shall see. Alan, anything across your radar this week that's worthy of note?
Very similar, really, guys. I mean, yeah, Mandel, I think, was a real standout for me. As you know, I've been banging on about just simply what's happening at that operation, you know, the helium production that's being scaled up, the US investor group, and then the comparisons to peer group. You know, we're seeing all of this, but of course, that's really, really front and center for me this week. Yes, the oil price, good to see, as you say, Dan, a recovery in Bitcoin and crypto. That's starting to move in the right direction, and I'm also scaling into Bittensaw as well, and that's had quite a precipitous fall, so I've picked up a bit of Bittensaw as well. So but yes, it's really all eyes on the Middle East.
Yeah, that's all that's it, isn't it, at the minute? Yeah, so who knows how long it will go on for and what we're in for. But as you say, Dan and Alan, and we're going to talk about Mandel in a moment. We did our podcast with Nick last week, and yes, it was the one stock that was actually up on the day. I think we re-recorded. It was doing extremely well, and you know, rightly so, because you know they're into helium. Of course, they've got producing wells, and the turmoil in the oil and gas market, of course, is going to affect them positively with them with the price differences there. But Dan, you're going to talk to us about Mandel then, and I would encourage people to perhaps head over to the Stopbox channels, YouTube, Twitter, LinkedIn, and check out that podcast, long format, about 45 minutes. Me and Dan talk to Nick all about his background and what led him to Mandel Helium, and ultimately his big, hairy, audacious goal. So listen in to see what he wants to achieve at Mandel. But Dan, let's get your take on it.
Yeah, so Mandel released an update this week that signals a pretty rapid move into the next phase of its development. The company already has a producing helium well in Kansas, and now it's preparing to drill two more, potentially increasing output significantly. And when you compare the you know, likely production from just these few wells with the company's current valuation of around 6.7 million, it starts to really highlight just how under the radar and undervalued this story still is. So before we get into Mendel itself, it is worth saying a quick word about the helium market. You know, helium is one of those commodities people don't think about that much, but it's actually critical to a huge number of modern technologies. It's used in semiconductor manufacturing, MRI scanners, space rocket technology, fiber optic production. So it sits right at the heart of a lot of industries that are driving the modern economy. And historically, supply has been relatively tight and concentrated with just a handful of major producers dominating the market. Recently, the macro backdrop has become even more interesting because helium is usually produced as a byproduct of natural gas and LNG production. And the situation in the Middle East around Iran is raising concerns that disruptions to gas flows could tighten supply even further. I think you've actually got a clip mark from Nick Tulloch, Mendel's CEO's appearance on BBC News this week, which was unexpected and great to see, where he does talk about this macro situation in a bit more detail, if you want to play that.
Indeed, let's play that clip now. It was great to see Nick on the BBC there, so let's have a listen.
Movement of oil and gas that is being hit by this war. Many other critical commodities are also in short supply due to logistical challenges. One example is helium. We're not just talking about something that's used in balloons. It's also crucial for making semiconductors, the functioning of medical devices, and running quantum computing, to name but a few other uses. The war in Iran has caused massive disruption to helium supplies globally, with Qatar, which usually provides around a third of global supplies, closing down production. So where does that leave the many industries which rely on helium? Let's speak now to Nick Tulloch, who's chief executive of Mendel Helium. Thanks for joining us today, Nick. How serious is this absence of Qatari helium when it comes to getting the right supplies to the right places, and crucially, I suppose, as well, at the right price?
Well, I think for the industry as a whole, it's very serious. I mean, as you say, Qatar is one of the biggest exporters of helium. I mean, on any day, it's exporting between about 20% and 35% of global helium. But their helium comes from a byproduct of LNG production. And if LNG supplies are being curtailed, production is being curtailed, and we're going to see a reduction in helium around the world. Now, that's probably going to affect Asia and Europe most as the biggest importers of Qatari helium. But it's going to flow right around the world.
Are there any other sources of helium that could pick up the slack now that Qatar has stopped production?
I mean, there are, and a new production is coming online all the time. I mean, the US is the biggest producer of helium around the world, but Russia and Algeria would be sort of in positions two and three. Now, Russia's obviously subject to sanctions. But I suppose the thing to bear in mind with helium is it doesn't come out of the ground in pure form. It comes out of the ground as a mix of other gaseous substances. So it's not just a case of turning on the tap and increasing production. There's a big capital investment in developing the processing facilities to actually turn that gaseous mix into a pure helium, which is what the industry requires.
What can those industries that we've mentioned, like semiconductor manufacturing, medical devices, are there ways in which they can cut back on their use, perhaps temporarily suspend production? Are those viable options?
Well, there is generally no substitute for helium in most of these industries. But I think what we'll see, I mean, you mentioned yourself, people think of balloons when they think of helium, first of all. I think we'll see different industries see supply reductions first. So balloons will probably be the first one to struggle with supplies. We'll probably see the price impact hit more at the medical devices, so MRI scanners, semiconductors, high-tech. These are industries that really don't have a choice. They need to use helium, and there aren't any particular viable substitutes at the moment.
Okay, Nick Tulloch from Mendel Helium. Thank you very much for joining us with that analysis today.
Yeah, what a great coup to get on the BBC News like that. That was quite a surprise, actually, and it timed very well with our podcast release. Completely coincidental. So I'm hoping that gets some eyes on it. But yeah, I'm surprised. I think you were as well, Alan, weren't you, to see Nick on the TV?
Yes, Nick sent us through the link. Literally, I think it was just after midday, and I looked at it and I thought, goodness me, you know, this is huge, you know, for a little company like Mendel. But there's so much happening in the world now, and particularly in the Middle East. And I think there are opportunities for company CEOs, you know, running companies with, you know, critical gases, oil, gas, and so on, to get on and put their perspective across. Of course, Nick does that exceptionally well. I think better than most. So yeah, great to see.
Yeah.
He definitely came across well in the interview, and like you say, it was a bit of a surprise, but good for him. So Mendel, back to the company, focused on helium production in the US. The company has exposure to the Hugoton gas system in southwest Kansas for its arrangement with M3 Helium. This is one of the most prolific helium producing regions in the world. It's been producing the gas for decades. But while that wider basin is strategically important, the company's immediate operational focus right now is on its Fort Dodge project, also in Kansas. And at the center of that project is its flagship well, Rost 1. Production began there in early November last year, and the most recently recorded flow rate in December was around 250 MCF per day, which equates to roughly $1.4 million worth of helium production per year. And that's an important number for a company of Mendel's size, because management has indicated that production from Rost alone is already sufficient to cover the company's overheads, which means the business is effectively able to sustain itself operationally while pursuing further growth. And that brings us to the update released this week. So the company announced that it has now received permits to move forward with two additional production wells at Fort Dodge. These wells are expected to produce greater volumes of gas than Rost, largely due to improvements in the way that they're being completed, particularly around the use of casing. So this isn't simply repeating the first well. It's an attempt to improve on the original model. And importantly, the drilling of these wells is already supported, at least in part, or maybe totally, through the placing completed earlier this year when the company raised around £700,000 specifically to support the drilling program with the support of some US investors on the ground. According to the update, drilling on the next well is expected to begin as soon as next week. So operationally, this represents a pretty rapid progression. The company is effectively moving from a single producing well to multi-well production system. And that's where the valuation argument really starts to get interesting. Like I said, at the moment, Mendel has a market cap of around 6.7 million. It may be slightly higher by the time this goes out. So remember that Rost 1 alone is capable of generating roughly $1.4 million per year in helium. So if these two additional wells were to deliver similar levels of production, and management actually expects them to deliver more, then suddenly you're looking at the potential for something in the region of $4 to $5 million per year in helium production across three wells. And that's a significant figure when compared with the company's current market cap. And it highlights just how little value the market currently appears to be attributing to the growth pipeline Mendel offers. Because beyond these first few wells, there's still a lot more upside in this story. Mendel has been steadily consolidating land around Fort Dodge, building up a larger acreage position with the aim of drilling additional wells targeting the same helium-bearing formations. Like you said, Mark, you asked him for his big, hairy, audacious goal in that interview, and he said, I don't know what the exact number was, but it's many, many more wells in this area. I think it might be like 20 or something.
Yeah, 20, wasn't it, I think, yeah.
So you can see the on the basis of that, the 1.4 million being generated at Rost, you can see you know, where revenues are heading. Then there's that broader opportunity within the Hugoton system for M3 Helium. There's also the company's Bitcoin mining initiative, which aims to use methane from production operations to generate additional revenue streams, though that does remain secondary to the helium business itself. And there's, of course, the possibility of higher helium prices, given the tightening supply situation that Nick covered on the BBC. When you step back and compare Mendel with its peers, the valuation gap becomes even clearer. Other companies listed in the UK trading at valuations in the region of like $60 million or more. You know, there's Pulsar, which is valued at over $100 million. Helix, which is around $64 million. Helium One's around $64 million too. I mean, these are all like 10 plus times Mendel's current valuation. And it's not like we're comparing a producer with an early stage explorer here. In fact, Mendel has the production and some of these companies aren't even at production yet. They're trading at those valuations on the strength of the potential scale of their assets. You know, Mendel's producing helium, it's operating in a premier US jurisdiction, and it's generating enough production from its first well to cover its overheads. And it has a clear and repeatable strategy. So you'd expect that valuation gap to begin closing over time as the company continues to execute operationally. Updates like the one released this week certainly helped move the story forward. The market response was good. But the event that could potentially accelerate that re-rating quite dramatically is the company's planned move from Aquis to AIM. That's expected to take place this month, I believe. And moving to AIM should significantly increase the company's liquidity, visibility, and allow it to access broader investor base. You just can't get on Aquis, I guess. And, you know, that could get the story to many more investors who simply aren't looking at Aquis-listed companies today. So, sum up, when you step back and look at the whole picture, you have a company already producing helium, expanding production for additional wells, operating in a strong macro environment for helium, and that is about to move on a larger public market, still valued at less than £7 million. And when you put all that together, I don't think it's hard to see why we all see this story as extremely compelling. I hold a position in stock myself, and I think it's a strong buy at these levels. And I know both of you, like we said, are big fans of the story as well. So I don't know if you guys want to extend on what I've said. Is there anything I've missed?
Well, no, I don't think you've missed anything. I think you gave the case quite well, but it's interesting, but also difficult to understand, isn't it, why some of these companies like Mendel that have got good management, who are doing the right thing, who are actually making money, who are actually in production, and are just sort of not getting the value recognition at the moment. You know, I take Buccaneer Energy as well. Of course, they're producing, making money from oil, and you know, oil's at nearly $100 per barrel, but yet that's still valued at about just over £1 million. So I don't know why it is, whether they need to, I don't know, do more PR. I'm not really sure. Maybe there's not enough blue sky. Maybe I'm not sure. I think with Mendel, it has to come, doesn't it?
I think also, I mean, obviously the BBC clip yesterday that we've just seen, you know, has done the company the power of good. It's brought it to a broader audience. Yeah. But I think also, you know, all of those factors, notwithstanding, you know, the potential to scale up what's happening at Ross. But there's also the Huguenin assets too, and Dan, you did mention those. But there is an agreement with Scout Energy, and of course, Scout Energy own the Jayhawk processing plant, which is based near Huguenin. So it's almost a plug and play solution, and they have a farming agreement with Scout Energy to develop wells in that region. So my guess is that once they've developed the Rost assets and the 20 wells, they'll start to look there too. So the potential scale of this company is absolutely huge, and that's what excites me. And you know, like you, Dan, we're also shareholders in the company too. So
I'm excited about this one. I think the last few days it does seem to have got some momentum. Hopefully that sticks. I think the AIM listing is only going to help on that front.
Yeah.
So blue skies ahead. Hopefully.
Indeed.
Indeed, hopefully. Okay, well, Alan, let's talk about another company that's doing fairly well. Well, a couple, actually. I mean, there's Sovereign and there is First Class as well. Which one did you want to take?
Yeah, well, let's start with Sovereign. I mean, the shares are really starting to push against year highs now, which is great to see, and quite rightly too. I mean, the company has a market cap now of about 300,000 sterling, but considering the asset the company owns, it's still very modest, and it's been cited on so many occasions as potentially being the next Fortescue Metals, you know. And some investment pundits in particular see the company multibagging from here. So, that's speculation, of course, but it's exciting nonetheless. So, Sovereign Metals and, of course, Dr. Julian Stevens at the time discovered the Kasia project in Malawi in 2019, after identifying a new rutile province. Now, of course, rutile is an oxide mineral composed of titanium dioxide, which has many applications. Of course, it's used in food, porcelain, glass, colouring, steel, copper alloys, welding, and also, of course, it appears in that brilliant white paint that you go down to the DIY shop and buy. So Kasia is today the world's largest known natural rutile deposit, and it's also the second largest known flake graphite deposit, and it holds the accolade of one of only 11 tier one mining projects discovered in the last decade. So make no mistake, it's absolutely huge. As I say, it's located in Malawi, which is the warm heart of Africa in the Lilongwe district. And strategically, it's well placed in that it's close to the deep water port at Nacala on the coast. And in terms of bringing the product to market, the company's gone through a series of tests that they've dug test pits to assess and run through the process of mining the pit, and it's all been very successful. They've also had the added benefit of having Rio Tinto come in as a major shareholder. Rio own about 20% of the company now. They've invested just under $60 million in total. They Sovereign and Rio formed a technical committee to oversee the development of the rutile processing and of course the land management too, which is a key aspect of any mining operation nowadays. The mining process is very simple. There's no drilling or blasting involved. It's just a conventional process that takes place through physical separation. And incredibly, the company announced late last year that, it was actually at the end of January. I'm getting ahead of myself here. Through processing those tailings from rutile, they had discovered heavy rare earth concentrate in the rutile tailing stream. So you've got the world's largest rutile project with an almost limitless supply of rutile, and you've got tailings that contain rare earth. So immediately, it's scaled up into another dimension of value, and that's basically arrived for free. That they've not had to do anything to discover that. That's come in, and it's a free add-on. And really, given the demand for rare earths today, should add a substantial dimension of value to the share price. So the rare earth discovery obviously gave the company a big drive forward this year, but the company management have been attending various meetings, and it was announced in February that Project Vault participant, of course, Project Vault is Donald Trump's initiative to store and safeguard key minerals, Project Vault participant has signed, Traxys Group has signed an offtake MOU for Cassia Graphite. So that was a huge feather in the cap for the company. But we've seen a series of memorandums of understanding and offtake agreements signed over the past year. There are offtake agreements with a welding company called Hasbro and various others. This week, the company announced it has signed a rutile offtake agreement with Japanese giant Mitsui, which is, again, a huge feather on the cap. Absolute industrial giant Mitsui are. So Mitsui are now involved as an offtake client with the other companies. So in summary, we're on the verge of completion of the DFS. The company announced in its half year that the critical components of the DFS were now completed. Over 400 individual tests conducted, covering mining infrastructure, tailings storage facility, raw water dam as well. But I mentioned restoration of the land because of the scale of this project. Obviously, a huge open pit mine has a significant impact on the community there. So the company's invested heavily into restoration processes, and also it's invested into the local infrastructure there, the local community, and it's also invested into farming. And the company have worked with sustainable farming methods, and they've doubled, in some cases tripled, the maize yield for the local farmers there. So basically, hugely improved the lives of the people living in the Lilongwe area. But in summary, Sovereign offers still massive potential and huge upside. Once that DFS is complete and production is underway, this is going to be the go-to company, both for rutile, of course, for flake graphite, and the graphite's high quality, suitable for battery anodes, and of course now for the rare earths as well. So it's a very complete mining investment opportunity, and that still offers huge upside.
Indeed, and it's of course nice to see that doing a little bit better recently as well, eh? Because it's been kind of stuck for a while in the same kind of price range. So it's nice to see it sort of heading towards those. It's on a year high, I think, isn't it?
It is pretty much. I mean, if you'd invested in December and picked up the stock, you could have picked it up at 24p, and you're now looking at 44, 45 pence. So, the year high is 51p. So
50. We're
not far off that, but I fully expect to see this go high, because there's a lot more news to come from the company as we go forward.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Alan. Good. Let's see how they continue to go, but they're doing the right thing. So back to you, Dan. URU, who I think you spoke to for the first time this week.
Yeah, that's right. So URU Metals released an update earlier this month announcing the start of a ground-based geophysical program at the Zeb Nickel Project in South Africa. So on the surface, that might sound like quite a technical development, but it's actually a pretty important step forward in the exploration process there, because the work now underway is designed to convert strong geological signals into drill-ready targets. And when you consider where this project sits, what the company's targeting, I think it really paints URU as an interesting story, particularly given the company currently has a market cap of just 6.3 million. So first, it's worth understanding where the project is located. Like I said, URU's main focus, Zeb Nickel Project, it sits on the northern limb of the Bushveld complex in South Africa. And as we all probably know, the Bushveld complex is one of the most important mineral provinces in the world. And as Richard Montjoy, URU's technical director, who I spoke to this week, said when I interviewed him, it really is elephant country. It's a place, sort of place where very large deposits are regularly found. So Zeb sits alongside major operations, including those owned by Ivanhoe Mines and Valterra. One of them's the largest open pit PGM mine in the world. So from a geological perspective, the address here could hardly be better. What URU is targeting specifically is nickel sulfide mineralization, and that distinction of the sulfides matters. Many of the world's nickel supply today comes from laterite deposits, but those deposits tend to produce class 2 nickel, less suitable to battery supply chains, whereas nickel sulfide deposits produce class 1 nickel, which is higher purity and more valuable for battery materials. And importantly, large sulfide discoveries are relatively rare, so projects capable of producing class 1 nickel are generally considered very strategically important. So Zeb has already shown encouraging signs of mineralization. Historical drilling has confirmed nickel sulfide mineralization across 4 stacked zones. So this isn't purely conceptual exploration. As Richard said in the interview, the mineralized system's clearly working. The ingredients of the cake are already there. The focus now is simply on identifying the best targets to drill next. For the latest program, the company had already completed an extensive airborne geophysical survey across the project, which was supported by its neighbors, I believe he said in the interview. That integrated gravity, magnetic, EM data, and identified a number of interesting areas, each supported by coincident geophysical anomalies. So URU already has a strong prospective area with like larger targets, and the new program is about refining those targets further before drilling begins. The company has now started using a ground-based geophysical survey over these areas. There's 2 techniques in particular. First, a frequency domain EM survey, which helps identify conductive rock. Second is a ground gravity survey, which maps the density of the rocks and helps define geological structures. So together, these provide a much more detailed picture of what lies beneath the surface. As Richard explained, airborne surveys are flown, you know, roughly 100 meters above the ground, and they go at very rapid speeds, obviously. And that means there's always some margin for error. Ground surveys, you know, they involve crews literally walking along prepared lines, taking measurements at regular intervals, so the data is much more precise. Yes, so the program has begun with line preparation, with people on the ground clearing narrow paths through the bush so survey equipment can be moved safely. Once these are complete, once surveys themselves are complete, the data will then be integrated into the company's 3D geological model. You can think of that, like Richard described it, as an MRI scan of the Earth. And then from there, the company will rank targets and design a drilling program to test them. And that drilling phase is the key milestone investors will be watching for next, because if drilling does confirm the presence of a significant nickel sulfide system, then the upside could be huge. You know, the project sits in one of the world's most proven mining districts. It already shows evidence of a working mineralized system, and the exploration program now underway is specifically designed to convert signals into targets. So you look at the valuation, it's around 6.3 million, and for a company exploring for nickel sulfides in the Bushveld complex, that really does seem very small. Exploration always carries risk, we all know that, but if the upcoming work successfully identifies and drills that sulfide system that I mentioned, the upside from this starting valuation could be considerable. So I think over the coming months, we'll be looking out for the completion of the surveys, the definition of targets, and then the drilling. And those steps will determine whether URU can turn the strong setting it has at ZEB into a meaningful discovery. You know, like Richard put it, the ingredients of the cake are all already there. Now it's about finding exactly where to drill and, I don't know, put the ingredients of the cake together. So yeah, definitely another one to watch out for over the, you know, next few months, next couple of quarters.
Okay, interesting. Good. I know, Alan, you know these guys quite well, don't you, as well?
Yeah, I mean, this project is absolutely huge, and I've interviewed Richard on a couple of occasions, but there's just been so much anecdotal evidence supporting the case for the ZEB Nickel project. So, I mean, in February, for instance, two peer-reviewed studies by Mapaloka were published in the Geology and South African Journal of Geology to provide new scientific evidence to support the ZEB Nickel. But, of course, alongside either side, you've got Ivanhoe Mines' Platreef project, which is absolutely huge. And as you said, Dan, you know, the Bushveld complex is one of the most important in the world. And then the Mogalakwena Platinum Group metals mine, which is the other side. So the geology is contiguous, runs through it. And it's it's not if, it's a question of how much and when do they start? You know, it's all there. So at a 6 million market cap, I mean, this should be many, many multiples of the current valuation now, in my view.
Yeah.
Okay. Good. Thank you both. So, Alan, let's finish off with you then and talk about First Class Metals, who had visible gold in their core, which is very unusual, isn't it? But very, very good. I'm sure Mark Sale's very happy about that.
Well, it's great. I think for First Class Metals, they've had such a, should I say, challenging year on a number of corporate fronts to finally get this result from Sunbeam is a massive feather in the cap. But certainly, if you look for an example of a CEO who uses social media on site and articulates the opportunity, very few people do it better than Mark Sale. And I think certainly some of the stuff that's gone out over the past week is really exciting. And yet here we are, 1.38p is the current share price, with a market capitalization of 3.8 million, which is ludicrous in my view for a company with the scale of projects and opportunities that it has. I mean, just to summarize, that the company's key projects they're all, of course, based in Ontario. It's a global hub for gold and critical metals exploration, the company's headline projects or key projects are, of course, the North Hemlo project, which covers which is in the Schreiber or the Hemlo Schreiber Greenstone belt, just 20 kilometers from the Hemlo gold mine, which of course is world famous. Of course, the focus there has been on the dead otter trend, the historical high grade results were recorded there. And the company had a bit of a disappointment in February, where it looked at the assay results from North Hemlo. The results were below expectations, but what the results did give the team were vectors And again, you know, what you drill into a certain piece of ground where you believe the mineralization exists. It's not there, but the anecdotal evidence and the minerals that you pull out of the ground give you an indication of perhaps where it should be. And indeed, that was what resulted from the North Hemna drill campaign. And the company is now going to re-examine that opportunity. But again, this is the attraction of first class metals. I'm going to come to Sunbeam in a minute, because obviously that's very much the star of the show at the moment. But we've also got other assets, for example, the Zigzag lithium project, which is to the north of the other assets the company owns. And this is a world-class zone for lithium, and it's close to several other companies, the Green Tech Metals Seymour Lake project, which has 2.13 million tons at 1.29% lithium oxide, the Junior Lake project, the Falcon Lake project. Again, it's very fertile territory. If you then look at the map of the assets the company has, we have a smattering of other assets too. Close to the North Hemlo asset, we have the ESSA project, which is being developed and pushed forward, and there are other projects which are, I wouldn't say they've been that they're being put on the back burner, but they're not priorities now. Certainly, Sunbeam is the key priority for the company, and Sunbeam is, of course, an historical gold mine, originally mined between 1898 and 1905, produced 944 ounces of gold from 650 tons of ore, and of course, with the team on the ground today, they've discovered a number of prospects. One in particular being the Roy prospect, and it was from that we had the announcement this week, of course, which announced the company discovered visible gold in one of the in core from one of the drilled holes. And this is a big step forward. I mean, when you have visible gold, that's a hugely important and encouraging a step forward for the team. The strike of the drill structure is currently over 250 meters, and they have Emerald Geological Services on site supervising the drilling program. The drill program is nearing completion, so we're going to get further results shortly. But I think it's really spiked everything back into life for the company, and Mark Sale and his team. Now, of course, we have the Roy structure. There are also other structures around the Sunbeam prospect. I'm sure once the team have completed with Roy, they'll move into the other opportunities that are provided sort of by Sunbeam. So, in summary, we have a company with three key assets, and a number of other secondary assets, which, with the progress at Sunbeam, I think we can safely say that there's going to be gold there in some quantity and format. So we're going to hear more about that in the coming weeks. But at 3.8 million market cap, none of this premium has been priced in.
No, I wonder if they've had a little bit of a tough time. They've had a lot of bad things happen, haven't they, recently?
Yes.
And I think that's possibly why the market's not showing them much love. But it's almost like it's sort of hit rock bottom, you know, and now they're sort of climbing out again. That's what I sort of feel anyway. With a series of quite bad setbacks and RNSs and disappointments as well, but that it seems like now it's almost like resetting, right, we're going again, and it's a good way to start as well. We're back on the ground exploring, and they've got that gold in the core. So hopefully it's a rebuild story from here.
Well, I think, of course, they had the debacle with the 79th group and a lot of corporate challenges, you know, but you set those to one side. So you've got the corporate issues on the one side, but operationally, you know, what the company, it's a mining company, and of course they're concerned with getting assets out of the ground. And of course, let's not forget, you know, they've got the tokenization program as well, which they're developing too. So the team are really pushing to build value from the assets that they have, and I think they've got ample opportunity to do that, particularly given that the Schreiber Hemlo gold belt and the surrounding areas are so fertile for mining companies. There are so many operations in that area.
Yeah. And Dan, I know you like first class, don't you, as well?
Yeah. No, I agree with what Alan's saying. I think it's a difficult time, you know, hard reset and a brilliant start. It's so small at the moment. It can, you know, you get a few more decent results out there and you can see this thing moving quite a lot.
Exactly. Yeah. Good. Well, let's see what goes on. Of course, gold is a great commodity to be in at the moment. So hopefully First Class can start to capitalize on that. But thank you both, as always, for your time. Again, another interesting week, as we said at the start. So we'll see if next week brings an end to the stuff going on in the Middle East, or if more surprises come my way. But do enjoy your weekends if you can, and we'll see you all next week.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, guys. All the best. Have a good one.
If you enjoyed this interview, then give us a thumbs up, a like, or a retweet. Subscribe to us on YouTube or follow us on Twitter, and hit that notification bell to be the first to know when we release new content. There's loads of great content on our website too, across all our programs at stockboxmedia.com. Thank you for watching.